The latter explaining that they hadn't thought to back up the train either, that the snow buildup in the rear of the train might have prohibited that maneuver anyway, and last, that he could watch the chief from the end of the tunnel. The engineer, whose name was Ralph Perkins, finally agreed to leave his chair at the helm. Higgins left unspoken the fact that the engineer might watch his beloved train hurtle down into the ravine at the front of a tsunami of sliding snow. Tom, Eleanor, Max, Misty, Cristobal, Father Kelly, and Agnes Joe worked as hard as the crew in pushing, pulling, carrying, assisting, cajoling, and hauling until all were safely ensconced in the massive tunnel. Agnes Joe proved herself particularly adept at crowd control and managing people. And she also had considerable strength in her frame, which she exhibited numerous times during the evacuation. Tom thought to break out his skis and gear, and Eleanor borrowed a pair from a female passenger who also planned to holiday at Tahoe. Together, the two ferried a large quantity of supplies over the packed snow with relative speed. Camp was set up in the tunnel. Tom went around and surveyed the situation. The lighting was very poor, the food levels low, the blankets too few. The worst problem, though, was the cold. With temperatures in the teens, the burden of less oxygen at their elevation, and the tunnel acting as a funnel for the tremendous winds, it was clear that neither the elderly nor the very young passengers could survive here long. As Tom contemplated all this, the conclusion became inevitable. He went over to the conductor, engineer, and Roxanne and spoke with them quietly but intensely. Eleanor, who was finishing helping folks settle down, glanced up and saw the meeting taking place. She joined them in time to hear Roxanne say, "You don't have to do this, Tom, but I love you for it." "I'm going with you." They all turned and looked at Eleanor. "No, you're not," said Tom. Eleanor looked at the others. "I taught him everything he knows about skiing." "Eleanor, I can't let you go with me." "I'm not asking for your permission. If you want to travel solo, fine. I'll have some coffee waiting at the resort for you when you finally show up." Roxanne hiked her eyebrows. "I think you'd be a lot smarter teaming up with this woman than trying to go it alone." Tom looked at each of them, and finally his gaze settled on Eleanor. "One more job together?"
"Let's go."
As Eleanor was getting ready, Max came over to her and sat down. "I hear you're going to ski to the rescue with Langdon."
"Well, we're going to try."
"It's dangerous out there, Eleanor. Are you sure about this?"
"More sure than I've been about anything in a long time."
"Tom's a big, strong guy. He can get it done by himself. I mean, he even told me about once carrying somebody up a mountain with mortar fire hitting all around."
Eleanor stopped packing and looked at him. "The person he was carrying was me, Max."
Max stared at her for a few moments and then said very quietly, with none of his usual bravado, "I just don't want to lose you, Eleanor."
She sat next to him, and they hugged. "I'll be back, if for no other reason than to write this script and win an Oscar."
"You really love this guy, don't you?"
"Do you believe in second chances, Max?"
"I guess I should. I've had more than my share of them."
"Well, I never did until now, and I'm not going to waste this one. I doubt I'll get another."
After saying their goodbyes, Tom and Eleanor, packed with gear, headed northeast back through the tunnel. From memory, Higgins had put together for them a rough map of the area and directions to the dingo. Tom carried the map in his pocket, wrapped in plastic. They'd go through the tunnel, start up a crevice in the mountain, and from there work their way north and west toward the resort. With any luck, soon they'd be drinking hot coffee in front of a roaring fire. The air was frigid and very thin at this altitude, and soon Tom and Eleanor were both breathing hard. The tunnel was completely dark, so they had snapped on their battery-powered helmet lights. They had to carry their skis because there wasn't any snow to use them on inside the tunnel.
"At least we don't have to worry about a train coming through," said Tom.
"And here I was thinking our luck was all bad."
As they walked a half mile to the other end of the tunnel, their hands reached out and gripped firmly. At the end of the tunnel, they strapped on their skis. "You ready?" Tom asked. Eleanor nodded. They stepped out into the blizzard.
managed to find the crevice in the near whiteout conditions, and headed up, each thrust of the ski poles arduous with the ascent. In a very few minutes, they'd completely disappeared into the storm's dangerous embrace. They pushed through the wind and walls of snow. Their bodies were caked with ice, their limbs growing increasingly numb. They constantly changed direction as Tom recalculated where they were. He had a compass, but he wasn't entirely confident that the instrument was telling him the truth. And trying to find a resort, albeit a large one, in the middle of a snowstorm on top of a mountain was a little more difficult than he'd thought. Yet, they plunged on. Tom and Eleanor navigated numerous steep ascents, often having to wedge their limbs and ski poles against the rocky sides to lever themselves on. In some cases, they had to take off their skis and, roped together, simply climb. After clearing all these obstacles, they reached a straightaway of flat land and made good time on their skis, despite heading directly into a wind that seemed to increase with each push of their poles. The first disaster occurred when Tom broke through a thin patch of ice and fell about 10 feet into a hole. With Eleanor tugging on a rope she tossed down to him, he was able to climb out. But he lost his cell phone, and even more devastating, the compass was damaged. They contemplated going back, assuming they could find the way back, but then decided to keep going. Tom had a good idea, he thought, of the direction, and had picked out some landmarks to help him maintain the correct course. Of course, with the snow blowing from every angle and things being covered and then uncovered because of the shifting powder, landmarks weren't all that reliable. Every step, every slope, every climb was made 100 times more difficult because of the inclemency, and they kept having to stop, turn away from the wind, or find a crevice in the rock to catch their breath. Both their chests burned, and their state-of-the-art clothing was barely holding its own against the numbing conditions. They found a decently protected area and ate a simple meal, although the water they'd brought was mostly ice. They rested for a while and then hit the trails again. When it started to grow dark, Eleanor said, "I'm not sure I want to be stumbling around at night on skis. Maybe we should make camp around here."
"Good idea. We can't be that far from the resort."
At least he hoped they weren't. For all he really knew, they were 10 feet from the train. They pitched their tent, and Tom got a small fire going using canned sterno. They used it to cook a quick dinner and also to thaw their water. They ate and settled back close together under the blankets to conserve heat and watched the snow pile up around them outside the tent. The storm seemed to weaken, and it grew quiet. They could now talk without having to shout.
"Just so you know, I told Lelia no. She took it very well."
"I'm surprised."
"So was I, until I learned why. Lelia has a new beau."
"What? Who?"
"Cristobal."
"Cristobal? You've got to be joking."
"I'm sure they'll be very happy together. Lelia can come up with another cartoon character based on a boa and call it Chris the Stick."
They grew quiet and snuggled closer.
"Have to conserve body heat," explained Tom.
"Absolutely," she sighed and then said, "Look, if we don't make it back..." He put a hand to her mouth.
"Let's try to think positively. Misty would probably call it a purple aura, a power or something."
She gripped his hand with hers. "If we don't make it back, I want you to know something." His expression grew serious.
"What?"
"I never stopped loving you, not after all these years." He put his arm around her.
"We'll make it back."
As Eleanor shivered, Tom wrapped his arms around her tightly, trying to wick as much of his body heat off him and onto her as he could. "Who would have thought we'd find each other after all this time and end up on a mountain in the middle of a blizzard?" she said.
"Hey, if it was easy, anybody could do it."
He tried to laugh, but his mouth couldn't quite make the effort. He remembered what day it was.
"Eleanor?"
She looked up at him. "What happened to Ellie?"
"Eleanor," he said, "Merry Christmas."
She managed to smile. "Merry Christmas." He dug something out of a zippered pocket in his tunic. I know this is the lousiest timing in the world, but like I said before, I am the king of bad timing. He rose, then went down on one knee and carefully put the ring on her finger. She looked at him, her lips parted, her eyes wide in amazement at what was happening. I realize it's been a long time in coming, way too long, in fact. But you're the only woman I've ever loved, and I'll do all I can to make you happy. Will you take me with all my faults, weaknesses, idiosyncrasies, pig-headedness, and outright stupidity? He paused, drew a long, even breath, and said, "Will you marry me, Eleanor?" She began to cry right after she said yes. As soon as they had finished sharing an official engagement kiss, the tent blew away and a load of snow fell directly on them, nearly burying them alive. Tom fought through the layers of snow and pulled Eleanor out. "We have to find shelter," he shouted over the wind. Now that they were officially engaged, Tom was going to do everything he could to make sure the ceremony actually took place. They struggled on, Eleanor growing weaker by the minute, so weak, in fact, that she could no longer walk unaided. Tom half carried her along for another quarter mile or so until his strength finally gave out too. He laid her down, took off his outer jacket, and covered her with it. Then he surveyed his dismal surroundings. They were in a flat plain, as far as he could tell, with the silhouettes of high peaks all around. That was all he could judge, since the snowfall made it impossible to see anything more. He said one final prayer, and then lay down on top of Eleanor, using his big body to block the snow. He sought out her gloved hand and held it tightly. The memory of his waiting in vain for his mother to pick up the photograph in the hospital came back to him, and he marshaled all his mental acuity and sense of touch to detect the slightest weakening of Eleanor's grip on his fingers. He didn't know what he would do if she started to fail. Maybe he'd simply say goodbye, something he hadn't done all those years ago. They seemed to be lying there for hours, the wind howling, the snow hitting his back, each smack like a tiny dagger into him. In Tom's mind, he could see the little boy reaching out to him. It was Tom as a small child, reaching out to his adult self, pulling him back to the relative safety of childhood. One's mind played tricks at times like this. He'd been in desperate situations before, but none, he had to concede, quite so perilous. This was, he concluded, after numerous near misses in his checkered career, probably his time to go. He looked at Eleanor and kissed her lips. She didn't respond, and the tears finally started to trickle down Tom's frozen cheeks. The little boy's image grew more and more vivid. Tom could now actually feel the fingers on his cheek rubbing his hair. The little boy was speaking to him, asking if he was okay. The vision was more real, more potent than any dream he'd ever had. He kept his grip on Eleanor's hand, even as he reached out to the young Tom, talked back to him. The child poked him again, and Tom's eyes fluttered open, closed, and then opened again, and the glare of sunlight was painful. So long had it been since he'd actually experienced it. "Are you okay, mister?" asked the little boy who was squatting next to him. Tom managed to sit up, look around. The storm was gone, the sky a vast azure blue, the sun warming, the air a chilly, pure freshness that only mountain heights could inspire. He stared at the boy, unsure if this was what heaven looked like or not, and finally managed to ask, "What are you doing all the way out here?"
"I live here," replied the little boy.
"Here? Where is here?"
The little boy pointed behind Tom.
"The dingo."
Tom looked over his shoulder. The mighty dingo resort, in all its splendid beauty and enormous redwood buildings, stared back at him. Eleanor and he had almost perished 5 feet from warm fires, hot chocolate, and hot tubs.
Tom stood on shaky legs, gently woke Eleanor.
"Are we dead?"
she asked, her eyes still closed.
"No," said Tom, "but just so you know, you're engaged to an idiot."
He carried her toward the main lodge as a number of adults finally spotted them and came running to help. Both ends of the tunnel were filled with sunlight, but not with any smells of cooking food, since there was none left. Still, at least the storm had passed, and Higgins, Roxanne, the conductor, Max, Misty, Lelia, Cristobal, Father Kelly, and Agnes Joe sat on the ground and discussed what to do next.
"I think," said Father Kelly with great sadness, "that a memorial service might be in order. For Tom and Eleanor, I mean."
Max said testily, "It's a little early for that, Padre."
"If they'd made it to the dingo, we would have heard by now. The weather has cleared," said the conductor. "Nobody could have survived all that time out there. I never should have let them go. It's my fault."
Roxanne said, "They were just trying to help two of the bravest people I ever met."
She pulled out a handkerchief and wiped at her eyes. Barry, the sleeping car attendant, burst into their circle and shouted, "Quick, you've got to see this. I was out checking the other end of the tunnel," he sputtered. "You just have to come and see this."
They followed him through the tunnel until they reached the other end.
"Look,"
he said. They stared at the horses and riders coming their way in a long, impressive procession. There was even a number of large sleighs pulled by teams of horses and loaded down with what looked to be supplies of all kinds. It was as though they'd all been transported back in time, and this was a wagon train of pioneers on their way to new lives in the unblemished West. One of the riders in front lifted his hat to them and called out,
"That's Tom," said Roxanne.
The rider next to him waved.
"And that's Eleanor," said Max.
He raced forward to meet them, slipping and sliding in the snow, but not slowing down. Misty said to herself,
"Six legs."
"What?"
said Cristobal.
"We were saved by six legs, four from the horse and two from the rider. Six legs."
She whooped and ran after Max, her long scarf dazzling in the beautiful and welcome sunlight. The timely arrival of food and other items from the good folks at the dingo lifted everyone's spirits. As the passengers ate and drank, people crowded around Tom and Eleanor and heard their amazing story of survival.
"The guys from the resort knew of this route to the train tracks that the horses and wagons could navigate. A lot easier than the path we took there, but you couldn't even see it with the storm going on."
Tom shook his head.
5 feet from the front door and didn't even know it. It's the luckiest I've ever been."
"It wasn't luck, Tom," said Father Kelly. "It was a miracle. I ordered up one special for you."
The conductor's walkie-talkie barked and he held it up and pressed the button.
"Go ahead," he said. "Amtrak Central to Southwest Chief, come in."
The conductor nearly screamed.
"This is the Southwest Chief Central." "Where is everybody?"
asked the voice.
"We evacuated the train. We're in the tunnel. What's the status of the rescue crew?"
"Just look out the tunnel, Homer," said the voice.
They all raced to the end of the tunnel, where there came a deafening roar as twin helicopters appeared over the ridge and hovered by the train.
"We got a replacement train on the western side of the landslide with 3 fully fueled engines," said the voice. "But how do we get to you?"
said Homer, the conductor.
"There's a mountain of snow between us, and there's snow piled high against the right side of the train." "Not for long. We've been working on this for a while now. Just stand by."
"Roger that," said Homer.
10 minutes went by, and then they heard a series of loud pops and watched as the 20-foot-high wall of snow in front of the chief collapsed and slid harmlessly down the mountain. The small explosive charges that had been very carefully laid out at key load-bearing points had worked their magic. Revealed behind the now-missing wall was the replacement train, its powerful engines running. The sound was particularly sweet and glorious to all on the long, silent chief. Next, they were ordered back in the tunnel while the choppers, nose down, hovered along the right side of the train and blew the very dry snow away, allowing the chief to resettle firmly on the tracks. Hundreds of volunteers swarmed off the replacement train and began clearing the rest of the track. Then another team came behind them and repaired the damage done by the slide, while the other volunteers cleared the snow from the sides and off the top of the chief. During all this activity, the passengers slowly reboarded the train.
It took most of the day to accomplish all of this, and the passengers on the Chief took the time to pose for pictures, call their friends and families, and convey suitably embellished accounts of their adventures, tales that grew taller and wilder with every retelling. Reporters reached some of the passengers on their cell phones, and soon stories were ringing the world about the dramatic rescue and Tom and Eleanor's heroics, with more sure to follow as soon as the train pulled into L.A. The children played in the snow and made angels, causing Roxanne to remark that the Chief surely had been watched over by more than its share of those fine beings. Early the next morning, the track was ready, the fresh engines attached, and for the first time in a long time, the wheels of the Southwest Chief began to turn. Special arrangements had been made permitting the Chief to make only a few of its scheduled stops, including a long layover in Albuquerque. As the train made its way down the mountain on its way through New Mexico and then into Arizona and finally California, the people on board did something they hadn't in a while. They rested peacefully. Chapter 32. As the train rolled through areas of New Mexico where the snow hadn't fallen, the earth turned reddish-brown, and everywhere were tall, craggy rocks that looked more orange than any other color. Sagebrush dotted this beautiful, if haunting, landscape, and the passengers stared out the windows, hoping to catch sight of an occasional homestead. They stopped in Albuquerque for about 3 hours to refuel and take on more supplies, and to let passengers stranded for so long take a walk and enjoy the sunshine after the weary battle they had endured at Raton Pass. Tom and Eleanor told the others of their engagement, and all were pleased by it, Max especially. Lelia even gave Tom a hug and wished him the best. From the way she was clinging to Cristobal and the young man's smitten expression, Tom figured it would only be a matter of time before their own nuptials were formally announced. Tom and Eleanor told their friends they might copy Steve and Julie and take their vows on the train. But only during the summer, said Eleanor. Avalanches weren't going to interrupt her wedding. There was a marketplace near the train station where Native American women were selling jewelry and other wares, and there was an old bus that had been set up as a retail outlet as well. Tom and Eleanor strolled in the sunshine and talked about their future together. "By the way, you never told me who you were seeing in Washington before you left on the train," Tom said. "Do you have a Lelia in your life?"
"Not exactly. It was my grandmother."
They stopped at a little cafe and had a drink and something to eat. Agnes Jo joined them, extended her congratulations on their engagement, and sipped a cool lemonade with them in the sunshine as she surveyed the surroundings.
"I sometimes think about retiring here and selling jewelry to the train passengers when they stop," she said.
Tom glanced sharply at her.
"Retiring here? I thought you were retired."
"Soon enough," she answered cryptically.
"What is it that you do?" he inquired.
"Oh, a little bit of this, a little bit of that."
"It's a funny thief that returns stolen items as gifts on Christmas Eve," he said.
"Craziest thing I've ever heard of," agreed Agnes Jo.
"Pretty generous of the crook," commented Eleanor.
"Not too generous, since he was only giving people back their own property,"
countered Agnes Jo.
"Or she," said Tom under his breath.
An Indian guide boarded the train before it left the station, and for the next hour or so, he regaled them with tales of the land, Indian reservations, and the history of his people. He got off at the stop in Gallup, known as the Indian capital of the world, because various tribes, including Hopi, Zuni, and Acoma, gathered for meetings there. After dinner, many people went to the lounge car and watched a video of the wedding ceremony that Cristobal and Max had prepared. Steve and Julie watched, laughing and occasionally crying as the special moment was replayed for all. To Tom, Steve looked particularly exhausted, and he noted with a smile that as soon as the film was over, Julie grabbed his hand and pulled him back to their honeymoon suite. It was late at night when they entered Arizona, and Tom found he couldn't sleep. He dressed and walked the halls. He looked in on Eleanor, but she was sleeping soundly, and he didn't want to awaken her. As he passed Max's compartment, he swore he could smell incense, and didn't that make perfect sense? He was afraid to go by Lelia's sleeper for the sounds he might hear coming from there. From personal experience, he knew that the woman who gave life to the innocent darlings Cuppy, Sassy, and Petey was a lot more racy in her personal life. Poor Cristobal would never know what hit him. While he was rambling around, the train slowed and then stopped. He peered out the window. There was a station here, but he thought there'd be no more stops until Los Angeles. He shrugged and kept walking until he arrived outside Agnes Joe's compartment. The woman's phonograph was still playing its Christmas tunes. Her unit was dark, and he assumed she must have fallen asleep while the music played. Then the phonograph started skipping, repeating the same lyrics over and over, and then degenerating into a nerve-rattling screeching sound. Apparently the woman was sleeping heavily and couldn't hear it. He tapped on the glass door. "Agnes Joe! Agnes Joe, your record player's going crazy!" There was no response, and he knocked again, louder. The screeching sound was only getting worse. He looked around and slid open the door. "Agnes Joe?" His eyes adjusted to the darkness, and he saw that the compartment was empty. There was no light on in the bathroom, but he tapped lightly on that door, receiving no answer. He eyed the duffel bag in the corner and was tempted to look inside again. He unzipped the bag and put his hand in. The newspaper was gone, but out came several items, including a watch, a pair of earrings, and what looked to be a very expensive pair of sunglasses. Maybe they were Cristobal's. Here was proof positive. He stood there trying to decide what to do when he heard footsteps heading his way. He put the items back and zipped the bag closed, shut the compartment door, and then slipped inside the bathroom. He prayed it wasn't Agnes Joe, but his prayer apparently went unanswered because the compartment door slid open and then was closed. The light came on, and he could hear footsteps. He'd left the bathroom door open a crack, and he peered out through this sliver. It was Agnes Joe, fully dressed in blue slacks and sweater. She held a piece of paper in her hand, and her expression was very serious. He just hoped she wouldn't need to use the John, but then how was he to escape? Wait until she was asleep? The woman didn't look ready for bed any time soon, and yet what choice did he have? He looked around and was about to back up slightly to sit on the toilet when the train started up again. The rocking motion was just enough to cause him to lose his balance. He knocked against the wall, and his hand shot out to steady himself, closing around the shower control and accidentally turning it on. The water hit him with a chilly blast, causing him to scream out a few choice words that, if he'd been Catholic, would have required a trip to Father Kelly for confession and a load of Hail Marys as penance. He managed to turn the water off in time to stare out at Agnes Joe, who'd opened the door and was studying him, as though he were a curious breed of animal at the zoo. "Hi, honey pie," said Tom with a sheepish grin.
"Would you care to come out here and tell me what you're doing in my shower?"
He emerged, wiped himself down with a towel, and explained about the phonograph, his coming in and getting rattled when he heard footsteps. The story might have worked if he'd zippered the duffel bag up all the way. But in the darkness, he hadn't quite managed it. Agnes Joe looked over at the bag and then back at him. He decided on a full frontal assault. He opened the bag and pulled out the items. "You care to explain what you're doing with these things? I'm willing to listen." She reached in her pocket. What she pulled out and pointed at him made Tom take a step back, his expression one of total shock. A few minutes later, an ashen-faced Tom rapped on Max's door. It took a few moments for the director to answer, and another minute or two before he opened the door. "I need your help," said Tom. "We'll need Cristobal, too." Max glanced behind Tom and saw Agnes Joe. "It's important," said Tom. They collected Cristobal from Lelia's suite, not without some resistance from the little lady, who voiced her displeasure in a decidedly non-Cuppy the Magic Beaver tone. They also woke up Roxanne and brought along Father Kelly, too. Converging in the lounge car, they sat at a table where Tom faced them. He pulled out Cristobal's designer sunglasses, Max's Bruno Mali's and Father Kelly's cross, and placed each in front of its respective owner. One man looked totally bewildered at what was in front of him, so confused that he never noticed Agnes Jo leaning toward him. Father Kelly gave out a yell as the handcuffs closed around his wrist. He tried to get up, but was wedged in by Max and Cristobal. Agnes Jo flipped out her credentials, the same action that had stunned Tom earlier in her compartment.
I'm Amtrak Police, Undercover Division, and you're our thief, John.
Tom looked at her. John? She nodded.
I got his fingerprints on a beer glass before we were stuck at the Raton Pass. At one of the station stops, I sent in an ID request. At the station we just left, I got a notice back. His real name is John Conroy, and he's no priest.
She sat across from the man, who looked so crushed, Tom's heart went out to him, despite the man's criminality. Agnes Jo continued her explanation.
I used my phonograph trick to make people think I was in my compartment when I really wasn't. I was afraid he'd spotted me lurking around and might decide to lay low for a while. When he performed the mass while we were stuck at the pass, I assisted him. I was already suspicious of him for other reasons, and that's why I lifted his prints. I did that for some others on board, too. He's obviously Catholic and could fake his way through the mass, but he made enough mistakes to make me even more wary.
And all the stuff I found in your bag? Asked Tom.
Roxanne had gotten those items for me from some of the passengers as evidence we might need later. I got you, Max, and Cristobal involved so we could take Conroy without anyone getting hurt or him suspicious. I swiped his cross out of his compartment. When I laid it down in front of him, I thought it would confuse him enough for me to get the handcuffs on with no scuffle. You're not a spring chicken, Conroy, but it's been my experience that you never know. Always better to take them by surprise.
I hate to admit this, but I looked through your duffel before and just found newspapers, said Tom.
I know. I could tell someone had searched it and thought it was probably you. The newspapers that Regina found in the trash were from Conroy's duffel. He had stuffed it full of old papers to make it look like it was packed as far as it could go. But once he got on the train, he ditched the papers and had a relatively empty duffel bag to fill up with his loot.
They all turned to the old man, who looked even smaller and clearly beaten as he sat handcuffed. Agnes Jo said,
Care to make a clean breast of it, John? I know you have a criminal record, but you could fill in some details.
He shook his head and said,
What will be, will be.
They called Big Barry to stand guard, and they trooped to the imposter priest's compartment, where a number of the stolen items were in his duffel. There was nothing of great value in any of it, but it was stolen goods nonetheless.
I'll call this in, said Agnes Jo.
What I don't get is why he returned so many of the items. What crook does that? Asked Tom.
Something is funny about that, said Roxanne. But at least we have our thief. Now let's all get some sleep.
Tom did just that until about 6 in the morning, when there was a tap on his door, and he woke up and answered it. Agnes Jo was standing there with 2 hot cups of coffee.
I thought I'd better bring this as a peace offering for waking you up so early.
She was dressed in blue slacks and a sweater, and she had a crisp and efficient air about her.
You'd make a great actress, said Tom. I had no clue that you were anything other than, well, I mean...
An eccentric old woman with nowhere to go during the holidays?
Yeah, it's a good cover. People say things around a character like that they otherwise never would. I've busted drug dealers, swindlers, theft rings, and lots of other bad people with my bewildered look, my stupid dresses, and...
And your honey pies.
Exactly.
Well, I suppose your cover is sort of blown now.
That's okay. I wasn't joking about retiring. It's time to move on.
So was any of the rest of your backstory true?
I worked for Ringling Brothers... Not as a trapeze artist, but as a horsewoman. I've been married twice, and I do have a grown daughter.
She paused and added,
And we are estranged.
Sorry to hear that.
Well, she read about the chief being trapped, and she called last night to make sure I was okay. First time I've heard from her in a while. We're going to see each other when I get into L.A.
She does work for the circus, and she's on the West Coast.
We're going to take another shot at it.
I'm happy for you, a late Christmas present. So what did you want to see me about?
Well, I've got a bit of a dilemma, and I wanted your advice. I obtained more info on our fake priest. He was busted years ago for petty thefts. I mean, almost 34 years ago. He's been straight since, real job and everything.
Why the return to crime after all that time?
His wife of over 33 years just died. I talked to Conroy, got him to open up some. With her gone, he didn't know what to do. He was lonely, just wanted attention. They had two kids, but one died in an accident and another from cancer.
Boy, that's tough. And it seems like his life of crime stopped when he married her.
Exactly. Now, I've dealt with lots of criminal types, and I've heard all the sob stories, and I'm not swayed by that stuff. But the other thing he told me, that's why I have the dilemma.
What is it?
He returned the stolen items on Christmas Eve as presents. The only ones he didn't return, the ones we found in his bags, were nothing much, and he left cash more than enough to pay for them. I've confirmed that with the passengers they belonged to. He didn't mean to hurt anyone. All he talked about was his wife. And he really helped when the train was stuck.
Tom let out a long breath. I see your dilemma.
What would you do?
He thought about it. Well, I got a second chance on this trip. And maybe John Conroy deserves one, too. Have you called the police yet?
Yes, but I gave him no particulars.
Is the train making any more stops?
It can at Fullerton, a couple of hours before we get into L.A.
Well, maybe the chief should stop at Fullerton.
Maybe it should. I don't think Conroy is going to jump into a life of crime. In fact, I know some people near Fullerton who can help him. She rose. Thanks, Tom. I think we made the right decision.
He smiled at her. So what's your real name? Agnes Jo let her frame droop and her face bloat out, and her hair seemed to whiten right before Tom's eyes.
Well, if I told you that, it wouldn't be a secret now, would it, Honey Pie?
Chapter 33. At Fullerton, the train stopped, and an elderly, tired-looking gentleman got off, no longer wearing priest's clothes. Some friends of Agnes Jo were waiting for him, and they drove off, hopefully taking John Conroy to a better life than felony by rail could ever provide. Tom went to the communal showers to get washed up before they arrived in L.A. As he was going in, Steve the honeymooner was coming out. The young man still looked very weary, yet Tom could hardly feel sorry for him, knowing full well the source of his fatigue.
"I thought you had a shower in your room," Tom said.
"My bride is hogging it," said Steve.
"Better get used to it, buddy," he jested, "and enjoy this part while you can."
As Steve left, Tom went inside the dressing area and started to disrobe. That's when he saw the wallet on the floor under the counter. He stooped to pick it up, thinking it must be Steve's. As he snagged it, some of the contents fell out, and he got down on his knees to retrieve them. He glanced at one of the cards he picked up, and the shock was as great as he'd ever had, perhaps even more than discovering Eleanor was on the train. He held the card up to the light and studied it. It was a SAG card, a Screen Actors Guild membership card, with the name Steve Samuels on it. Tom quickly looked through the rest of the wallet. He found Steve's driver's license, his California driver's license, and the picture confirmed that it was Steve, of Steve and Julie, only he wasn't a student at George Washington. He was 28 years old and a dues-paying member of the Actors Guild. Ironically, the Southwest chief pulled into the beautiful Art Deco Los Angeles Union passenger train terminal a few minutes ahead of its revised schedule. Herrick Higgins was met by several senior Amtrak executives, congratulated and thanked for his heroics. And then he was offered his old position back, riding the rails troubleshooting, an offer he accepted on the spot. Max Powers got off and answered lots of reporters' questions. He looked over to where Roxanne and the boys' choir were doing the same.
"Hey," he called to Roxanne. "I'll be in touch. Count on it."
She smiled.
"I am, baby. I am."
Then he and a group of passengers, including Cristobal, Lelia, and Misty, left the station and got into a stretch limousine waiting for them outside.
As the driver went to get their luggage, inside the limo, Max took out three envelopes and handed them one by one to Steve, Julie, and the minister. Then he popped a bottle of champagne and poured out glasses of the bubbly for all.
"Good job, guys," said Max. "You'll all be in my next picture. Who knows? Maybe it'll be about the train."
Misty said, "Max, when you told me what you'd done, I couldn't believe it."
"Well, sweetie, though I'd known you only a short time, I knew you could keep a secret for the right reasons."
"True love," she said wistfully. "You couldn't believe it," said Lelia. "How do you think I felt? Max Powers calls me after all these years and asks for a favor. Some favor to fly out to Kansas City and pretend to propose. I don't know what I would have done if he'd accepted."
"I know my man, Lelia. I was pretty sure he wouldn't."
"Pretty sure?
I had to make certain he didn't really love you and you didn't love him."
"Of course not, especially after the Eric incident."
Cristobal gave a sympathetic nod.
"A lady needs to be pampered, and from now on, that's my job, kitten."
She patted him on the arm. Max beamed.
"You're a fine actress. And see what you gained from my little plan?"
"You never told me you had contacted Lelia and included her in the plan," said Cristobal. "I had no idea who she was until she told me her name."
"I'm a man who has this insatiable need to surprise people," replied Max.
"What part were you playing, Max?" Lelia asked.
Misty said,
"Why, Max Powers, of course."
Max smiled. "Like Olivier and Hamlet, it's my greatest role."
"You were right, by the way, sir. He asked me about the booking dates, and then, as you predicted, he went to Regina."
"He's a world-class reporter, Cristobal. He wouldn't take your word for it. That's why I had Regina in on it."
"And you did all this for Eleanor?" asked Misty. "And she doesn't know about any of it?"
Max nodded.
"Not a thing. Eleanor is the daughter I never had. I'd do anything for her. As long as I've known her, she hasn't been truly happy. I knew there was something in her past. Now, she never told me his name, but I did some snooping and found out that Tom Langdon was the big loose end in her life. She couldn't go forward until she knew it was either over or they were finally going to get married. So I've been tracking the guy for about 6 months. When he booked this trip, it was a perfect opportunity for me because I really wanted to do a train film."
"And the wedding?" asked Misty.
"What better way to make people who should have gotten married rethink what might have been than to put them in a wedding together? So Julie is from the same sort of place Eleanor is from, and Tom reads Steve the Riot Act after he starts to waver on his decision. That was a good twist because it may as well have been Tom saying all the things he was feeling. Of course, that was all planned. Every time Tom and Eleanor had a blow-up, we had a plan ready."
Cristobal said wearily,
"And they had lots of blow-ups. It was draining keeping up with them the whole trip." "You did good, Cristobal, and I'm not cutting your pay. Happy holidays."
"That's a lot of details you covered, Max," said Misty.
"I'm a director, sweetie. My whole life is details."
Sir, you didn't somehow order up the avalanche, did you?" Cristobal wanted to know.
"Hey, even I'm not that good."
There was a rap on the window.
"Must be the luggage," said Max.
He rolled the window down. Tom leaned in and looked at them all. Max said nervously,
"Hey there, Tom. Just giving the newlyweds a ride to their honeymoon palace."
"I'm sure," said Tom. He handed Steve his wallet. "You dropped it in the shower. Your driver's license and SAG card are in there. Figured you'd need them."
"Tom," said Max, "I can explain."
Tom held up a hand. "I only have one thing to say to you." Max drew back.
"What's that?"
"Thank you." Tom shook hands with Max and then looked around at everyone.
"Merry Christmas and happy holidays," he said.
He walked away from the limo and found Eleanor, who was with their bags and watching him curiously.
"Who was in the limo?"
she asked when he reached her. Tom turned and glanced back at the car pulling off. He looked back at Eleanor. "Santa Claus," he answered.
"Santa Claus? Right. We're a little old to believe in Santa Claus."
He put his arm around her as they walked off.
Well, around Christmas, it can be a good thing to believe in magic. You never know. Your wish just might come true.
This has been an Hachette audio production of The Christmas Train. Written by David Baldacci. Read by Tim Matheson. Featuring a bonus story, Waiting for Santa, read by Brad Negbar. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Linda Ross. Production supervised by Dennis Kao. The Christmas Train is also available in print and as an ebook from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2002 by Columbus Rose Limited. Audio production copyright and published 2002 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Waiting for Santa. How do you learn how to live again after holding a warm child in your arms, wanting nothing more than to love and protect her from all harm, and then having to give her up forever less than 24 hours later? I've pondered that for the last 8 years, ever since my wife died during childbirth on a Monday, and our day-old daughter Sarah followed her on Tuesday. I had gone to the hospital expecting to leave with the two people I loved most in the world. Instead, I went home alone to arrange for twin funerals. The hardest time of the year for me is Christmas, because Sarah was born on December 24th. For the last 8 years, I've come to the mall to watch the long line of children waiting their turn with Saint Nick. And each year I go home afterward and cry myself to sleep for never being able to hold Sarah's hand as she anxiously waits to whisper in Santa's ear. My family and friends keep asking me when I'm going to get on with my life. I've stopped trying to answer because I don't know what the answer is. In many important ways, my life ended with the deaths of my wife and child. I'm not certain that I'm entitled to another one. This year, as I stood watching the long line of kids and parents, a little girl of about 9 appeared near me. She was small, with curly brown hair clustered around a perfect oval face that framed enormous green eyes. She looked familiar, but I was sure I didn't know her. "Hey, mister, can you stand in line with me? My granny's knees aren't so good." She pointed to an old woman who sat nearby. Before I could answer, she took my hand and led me to the end of the line. She said, "I've seen you here before." "Yes," I replied, "you probably have."
"Only you just watch."
"That's right," I said, "I just watch."
"Your kids don't like Santa?"
"I had a child, but she died." I don't know why I told her this, but I suppose I was unable to lie to a child. She patted my hand.
"I had a mom and dad, but they died too. Granny says it was in an accident."
"I'm sure you miss them."
"I didn't really know them, but you have to miss your parents. It's a rule."
A good rule, I thought.
"What are you going to ask Santa for?"
"Same thing I ask for every year, a mom and dad." I looked at her grandmother. "I'm sure your granny loves having you with her."
"I'm a lot of work," she added, "and she's not as young as she used to be."
"You want to be adopted?"
"It's the right thing to do," she said confidently.
The firmness of her words startled me.
"I'm not sure I understand." "I can make someone another family, someone who doesn't have kids."
"I guess that's one way to look at it, making a family that way."
"Lots of people can do it."
"I suppose," I said absently. I was growing a little uncomfortable holding the strange girl's hand, but every time I tried to pull away, she gripped my fingers tighter.
"Yeah, even people like you. But you have it easy. It's harder for me, she said. I stared at her. What do you mean? I have to wait for a grown-up to want me. It's not that easy for me either, I said. Grown-ups have their own limitations. But it happens every day. You'll make a new family, and then you won't have to come here and just watch. I can't replace the family I lost. No, you'll actually have two families. Two families of memories. That's pretty lucky when you think about it. Most people only have one. Right now, I don't really have any, so when I get a new family, I'll only have one set of real memories. But I've already made up memories of my real mom and dad. I'll never forget them. That's a rule, too. I smiled. I've never known a child who liked rules so much. It's easy when you love someone, like your kid. I bet you loved her a lot. More than anything. I felt myself tearing up and I swiped at my eyes. Well, once you love someone, that's it. That love will always be there. But what about her? She died when she was very young. She didn't even know me. Like you said, you don't remember your parents. You had to make up memories. But that's different. I don't remember them in one way, but I remember them in another. It's from their love. I know my mom and dad held me close before they died. I know they wanted me. I know they loved me. And once they love you, you never forget it. You can't take it back. It's inside of you forever. I know that. And so did your little girl. Another rule, I said weakly, as an overpowering sensation of hope flooded me. Actually, the most important one of all. She went and sat on Santa's lap. When she was finished, she waved to me. Thanks, mister. As she walked off, I asked, what's your name? Sarah, she said, before disappearing with her grandmother. I was married a year later, and a year after that we had a son named Timothy. I took Timothy to see Santa when he was 2 years old. As I was standing there, I noticed the old grandmother sitting nearby. I looked around for Sarah, but didn't see her. Leaving my son with his mother, I went over to the old woman, introduced myself, and asked if her granddaughter Sarah had been adopted. The old woman looked at me curiously for a moment. I don't have a granddaughter. I was less shocked by this than I probably should have been. I walked back to my son, took his hand, and led him to Santa Claus. My wife and I hugged while our son jabbered his wishes into Saint Nick's ear. As we left to go home, I said a silent prayer of gratitude for both my families.